with me.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. As long as it feels like renunciation, it's probably not time. There's a story in India that's said to be true of a man whose wife came to him and said she was very concerned about her brother because every year he was renouncing something else. And she was afraid that he was going to leave the family. And the husband said to the wife, he said, "No, he'll never leave the family." And he said, "Why?" He said, "Because that's not how renunciation happens." And the wife said, "Well, how does it happen?" And he said, "Like this." And then as the story goes, he took off all his garments except he took his dhoti and ripped a piece of it and tied it around his waist as a loincloth. He bowed to his wife and said, "From this day I regard you and all women as the Divine Mother." And he walked out and never came back. Because that's how it really happens. Just sort of, all of a sudden, it's just not yours anymore. And you just leave. It's not like you squeeze it out of you. It's like you develop vairagya. You can't hold it anymore. Sometimes God rips it away and then you realize you didn't want it. But ideally, you just open your hands and let it go. And even if you live in the world, as he writes in the autobiography, you know, the householder path is the higher path, provided that the householder lives unattached and uninvolved egoically with all that's happening. So the inner renunciation is the true renunciation. Rajasi Janakananda was a millionaire, but he was also a fully realized master by the end of his life. And he didn't renounce it, he just transcended it. So the example is there whether we change our lifestyle or not. All right? Any comment? The word renunciate is a wonderful word. If it frightens you, don't worry about it now. But if it doesn't, enjoy it with your whole heart. Then Master, the next few chapters, four chapters, in fact, about great saints that he meets. You know, we didn't read about the Tiger Swami or the Perfume Swami, who were lesser souls, in a sense, than the ones that we read about now, which is the levitating saint, Bhaduri Mahashaya, and then Master Mahashaya, M. And the levitating saint who lived in Master's neighborhood, it's so charming that all these people were right there. And again, when you go to India, I'm thinking about this now because of Devi Van Mali being here, the mind has turned to India where we're going in a few months. But you go to Master's house at 4 Garpar Road, and then you walk up the street a little bit, and there's the house where Tulsi Bose, his boyhood friend, lived, and Master stayed in 1936. Then you walk around the corner, and you're at the house of the levitating saint. And there's still it's still set up with a hall there. It's sort of an ashram, and there's these little, a couple of little temples with little statues of Bhaduri Mahashaya sitting there. And you can really feel, it's very palpable, the spiritual power. And it's not unusual, really, to sort of together a little bit, because great saints, there's more power together, you know, rather than being dissipated in lots of directions. So, and Bengal and Calcutta have always been the heart of devotion in India in many ways. And so there's always a great devotional ferment in that part of the country. And also, as I've mentioned in the notes here, you know, the saints get better and better as we're getting up to Sri Yukteswar. It's sort of Yogananda's luring us in to a deeper appreciation of what a true spiritual person is. He gets our attention with someone like the Tiger Swami, which is a pretty stunning story, you know, and the perfume saint is sort of comical, but the levitating saint is a true one, and we have just the peculiarity again of the eccentricity of the divine. Here's this saint who never goes outdoors, and you're sort of like, why? And he just says, well, so that just because God likes things to be unexpected, lest we get it all put into a little box and think that we know how it's really going to be. Eccentricity absolutely abounds in India. It's just so commonly accepted that people would be eccentric. I mean, Devi Van Mali herself, you notice she was wearing this lavender outfit. And this is something she just made up. You know, she's a devotee of Krishna and she considers this lavender purple color to be Krishna's color. And I don't know when in her life she just converted to this purple garment. She has three of them, I mean, she has three of them on her trip with her. It's all she wears every day. I was just thinking, what a wonderful idea. You know? Just have the same thing and have three or four of it and just wear it every single day. She's not a swami. She's not a formal renunciate. She has children and grandchildren whom she adores. And she dresses every day in this lavender garment. And it's a style that is recognizable, but nonetheless, it's her own. And she's a very highly educated woman from a very upper-class family, so I'm sure she wasn't raised like that, although she said her family was always Krishna Bhakta, devotees of Krishna. But that kind of eccentricity is just taken for granted, especially if it's spiritually motivated in that culture, because the whole culture is just based on spirit. So Bhaduri Mahashaya just sort of having this peculiar vow that he's taken, which is he never goes outside, from some inner calling that this is really how he should be. What is there to see in the world, you would say? I'm sure he had such thoughts like, why do I need to go anywhere? The entire divine panorama is available within me. And it stands in contrast, too, in a very profound way to our compulsive need to go everywhere. You know, just run around and see things and do things. And he never left his home, except on holidays, and then he would come out to the sidewalk. You know, like, this is a big day, I'm going to the sidewalk, right? But think of the level. I mean, there's so much implied in that. You know, think of the level of inner calmness. And he wasn't, you know, a person can become small-minded from such things. Swamiji was talking about when he was living in India, he went to the Kumbh Mela. The Kumbh Mela is a gathering of saints and sadhus that happens, the big one happens every 12 years, and all the sadhus come out of the mountains, and it's just a time. And these incredible traditions in India. Every 12 years, all these saints and sadhus who are just hidden away, all just come to this holy spot, and they all just gather. And for a period of days or weeks, they're all there, and people can come and have darshan, and they can see one another, then they all go back. And they've been doing this for centuries like this. Nobody knows why. Now it's all so overpopulated and out of hand that it doesn't work quite as well. But nonetheless, they still do it, and it's still there. It's the overpopulation of India is warping the culture, and the disintegration of Kali Yuga is warping the culture. But nonetheless, the traditions are holding, and they'll still be there after Kali Yuga is gone. But Swamiji was talking about, he said that you'd see sadhus who do many strange things, like sometimes you see some that like have promised to like hold a hand in the air, and then just for years of their life they'll just do this tapasya of just holding one hand in the air, or sadhus who never lie down or sit but just stand or lean. And Swami was talking about some, he said, so many of the time you see people who've done things like that and their bodies have become grotesque from the unnaturalness of it. And then Swami talked about one, he was talking about the sadhus who perhaps never lie down. Sometimes their legs become swollen and so on from just the unnaturalness of it. But then Swami talked about one sadhu that he saw there who was following one of those extreme practices, and many of his companions were somewhat grotesque from it. But he said he was shining and beautiful and perfectly formed, and even his body hadn't been affected. It was, for him, it was the right sadhana. And you could see that it had given him enlightenment. Very peculiar. And India sort of does that to you. And Master's trying to do it to us with this book, just trying to get us into a culture whose value system is completely different. You have to think not in terms of the present poverty and aberration of India. But even still, 50 years ago, which was not nearly as bad as now, Yogananda describes in the very first sentence, very first paragraph, these men of God realization are India's sole remaining wealth, is what he said. Later editions say only true wealth. But Yogananda was very blunt. He said sole remaining wealth. They toned it down later, but he didn't tone it down. So we have Bhaduri Mahashaya, who sits upstairs and just is this saint and has somebody at the door to keep most people away because, as he says, saintliness is disconcerting. Just the simple truth is not what most people want to hear. So for their protection, I don't let them come. You know, it's just a very interesting statement. We all think, oh, we should be, you know, have the right to be by masters and with saints, and why weren't we incarnated with Yogananda and so on? Well, maybe might not have been such a good idea for us. You know, Bhadurya Mahashaya held himself away from many people because the simple truth that he would speak bluntly was too much. Sri Yukteswar did not cultivate many disciples. He was too blunt spoken for most. They found his words too caustic. They didn't find them healing. They found it too difficult for him. But Yogananda, of course, saw through the facade, and that was sort of the sweetness of his relationship with Bhadurya Mahashaya, was that he himself was so focused on the divine reality that they could entirely connect. And of course, Yogananda's just a boy, but he was not a boy on any spiritual level at all, and their souls attuned with each other. And interestingly, Yogananda explains in several different ways in this chapter about how he really liked this man's sense of humor and would laugh all the time, and that it was a little disconcerting to the other disciples. And it's just a very small statement, but it's also a kind of a sign, number one, that he was really in tune with the saint, and number two, that Master just responded in whatever way he wanted to respond. You know, it's a very little thing, but he didn't have any regard either for what small-minded people thought of him. He just responded, and they didn't like it, but that didn't matter because his relationship was just with the levitating saint here. And then Master starts bringing in, you know, this saint talks about Westerners, and here this is like when? Before 1920. And Bhadurya Mahashaya is corresponding with people in the West about yoga and just sort of introducing the energy. You have to appreciate that the kind of divine mission that Yogananda brought to America required a great deal of preparing of the soil. And so Bhadurya Mahashaya was not really, quote, of this line. He wasn't Yogananda's guru, but yet he was also just sort of planting the seeds in the West, getting ready for this movement of self-realization to come. I actually had a thought not too long ago that that I wonder to what extent this line of teachers, this line of gurus was involved in the actual founding of America. You know, which of the founding fathers or may have been saints related to this path. For this reason, that you have, if you think in these very long cycles, I mean, we're talking in terms of centuries, that this the planet is going through this great shift. Swamiji talks in his autobiography, The Path, and Yogananda speaks of it too in many different ways in here. The extent to which the world is really run by the vision of the masters. It's a very interesting and important idea to sort of contemplate. I mean, like, who and what is really in charge? We can even say that God is in charge, but you have to appreciate that even the divine works through instruments. It's not as if God is sort of abstractly in charge and then just things just sort of happen. It's the power of the divine comes through human consciousness, and human consciousness receives that and acts on it and manifests it in a human way. And so you have apparent individuals of influence, and then you have invisible influences that are nonetheless still completely there. Babaji lives even now in the Himalayas and has promised to keep his physical form throughout this age and is responsible with Jesus for the spiritual evolution east and west. I mean, those are statements that Yogananda makes, and we read them and we say, uh-huh, you know. But really, just stop for a minute and think about what that really, really means, about sort of the forces that are at play. And then we talk about being in tune and trying to be receptive to the Guru's will, and we pray. We have all these prayers that we say over and over. You know, help me, make me an instrument of your divine consciousness. Well, what do you think that really means? That really means to be an instrument of divine consciousness. And it's not just, oh, now that I'm about to meditate. It's every decision that we make, every action that we take, where we work, what kind of work we do, what we do when we're working, where we live, how we, just everything about us. Where does the ideas come from? Where do the ideas come from? Well, they either come right out of our subconscious, or they come in some sense out of our superconscious in relation to the infinite. And how does the infinite reach us? Through these masters. Yogananda said shocking, startling things like, it was he who put the thought into President Truman's mind. to defend Korea, in Korea, to go into the Korean War, because Yogananda has always said explicitly that communism is the greatest threat that the world faces at this time because of its atheism. The atheism represented by communism is a profound and terrible threat to the future of this world. And so Yogananda said it was he who put the thought into Yogananda's mind to enter the Korean War to stop the spread of communism, because if it had gone through Korea, it would have just proliferated throughout that whole part of the world. I mean, for those people who are pacifists or who have sort of small ideas of history, it's like you don't quite know what to do with that. And Master also said that it was the masters of India who put it into Hitler's mind to divide his forces between Europe and Russia. So he ended up fighting the war on two fronts. And it was because he was divided and because so much of his energy was in Russia that Hitler was able to be defeated. And from a military point of view, apparently, I don't study these things, it was a very stupid decision and uncharacteristic of him. But Yogananda said the masters of India put the thought in his mind and persuaded him that it was a good idea, and so he acted on it. And you think, wow, you know, what is really actually happening here? So in that context, Yogananda has said that India and America are the leading forces for Dwapara Yuga. And that ultimately, in fact, Yogananda even talked about great wars of many different combinations that will ultimately end up with India and America being allies. India is far more allied with Russia than it is now with America, but the balance is shifting a little bit. Bill Clinton did a lot to do that. Bill Clinton was just a phenomenal success in India. We hear from all our Indian friends. He did a lot to increase pro-American feeling in India. You never know who can be used for what. But anyway, but in that context, I started thinking, because you see, and I think I talked a little about this last week, India, America is unique, has this unique ability. Somebody was talking about the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I mean, at the time that those words were written, that was an extraordinary revelation, to say it's self-evident that all men are created equal. It was not at all self-evident. I mean, it was a society in which the aristocrats were people and everybody else wasn't, you know, and the king was something and everybody else wasn't. And the American people said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal and have the same right to the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. I mean, we can barely comprehend what an extraordinary, bold, and daring experiment America was and is. Now that we've just sort of gotten used to it and become actually quite cynical and disrespectful of it, we don't realize that. But it occurred to me, and I was asking Swami about it, that since America has such a profound role to play, I mean, Yogananda came, all these avatars were all working up to sending Yogananda to Los Angeles. I mean, that's really something when you think about it, right? Yeah, it's quite something. To America, to California, to Los Angeles. And Yogananda said great saints and sages had lived on that soil, and it was holy soil, Los Angeles. I think some of them lived in Northern California too, but anyway. But nonetheless, so I was saying to Swamiji, I said, well, if America had such a role to play, and just tuning in slightly to what a revolution it was, I said, the masters must have been involved. And Swamiji said, well, yes, of course, that's true. And I mean, in 300 years, 200 years is nothing in the time span that we're talking about. You know, and Abraham Lincoln and George Washington, particularly among presidents, were extraordinarily known for their spiritual power and their spiritual intuition. They were very exceptional men, both of them, and Washington founded it and Lincoln saved it.